Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
In the year 2022, 1 million Bangladeshis die in a great cyclone. In 2025, the U.S. begins construction of a 9-foot-high razor wire big fence along the Mexican border, complete with landmines and remotely controlled machine guns to stop climate refugees who are fleeing endless drought. China implodes in 2036 as tens of millions starve. In 2051, New Orleans faces its final destruction. Sound far-fetched? According to my guess, those are but a few of the possible disasters we could face as temperatures rise over the next 50 years. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. If escalating global warming will produce, as many scientists predict, mega disasters such as heat waves, volcanoes, floods, droughts, wildfires, and storms 10 times more powerful than Katrina, what will happen to the world politically and demographically? Will globalization break down as nations fight for resources? What will happen to the world's financial systems, food production systems, and political organizations such as the United Nations? Joining me to talk about the geopolitical consequences of climate change is Gwynne Dyer, a freelance journalist and specialist on international affairs, whose provocative new book is entitled Climate Wars: The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily.
What led you to write this book? It's a kind of scary book. What made you think we needed a book showing us what would happen if the world overheats?
Well, I was in Washington. I go there a few times a year because you got to sort of keep up with whatever is going through their little minds. And a friend of mine just mentioned to me in passing that the Pentagon was getting interested in climate change. Now, I've been writing about climate change for years because it's one of the subjects that come up. You do two columns a week, It'll come up once in a while, but I can't say that I had a deep and abiding interest in it, but this was weird. So I asked the friend why, and he said, I don't know, but here's a few people you might want to talk to, who I did talk to them. And lo and behold, yes, in, I guess, 2007 we're talking, so in the depth of the Bush administration, when it was definitely a career-killing move to talk in public about climate change, the Pentagon, specifically the Joint Chiefs of Staff Planning Section, were looking into the jobs that climate change, global warming, would produce for the U.S. Armed Forces. Now, that's interesting. So I actually went back to London, where I live, and I thought, well, next step is see if the British Armed Forces are doing the same thing, and lo, they were. In fact, that's where I first heard the phrase, Lifeboat Britain.
Lifeboat Britain.
Because they reckon, to cut a long story short, that when everybody else is really suffering from killing heat, the crops are dying, refugees are overrunning them, Britain, A, is an island, so it won't get overrun by refugees, and B, being an island, it's surrounded by sea and will be relatively cool, and therefore they have got a chance of continuing to the end of the 21st century in a more or less familiar pattern, though most of the world doesn't, if you keep the refugees out. So I thought, okay, this is something I had not reckoned on, and it's certainly worth more than 875 words with indicated cuts to 725, And I do a good deal of travel in the job anyway, so I just began to add, a couple of generals, a couple of scientists, and one or two policymakers or think tank experts in each capital as you sort of go through them over on an 18-month cycle. That's sort of the major capitals. And it turns out that, the military everywhere are developing a keen interest in climate change because, one of the things about the military at a senior level is that they have actually a professional responsibility to detect emerging threats to the state. That's their job. And, It also suits their purposes in the sense that they've got to have some kind of problem to solve or there won't be a defense budget anymore. So the two things sort of go together, and it's not in the least surprising once you think about it that if there is a serious threat emerging, they'll be the first on the scene. Well, they're on the scene in a big way.
So if the military is involved, it suggests that they see it as a potential threat to global relations, that they see it as something that could really be disruptive.
Oh, yeah, very much so. They're, like everybody who gets drawn into this business, they're well aware that the problem will become more and more visible and pressing with the passage of time, but it's very hard to get people to move before it is visible and pressing, even though that's too late to prevent it from arising. So, for example, one of the things the U.S. Army worries about, in fact, it might even be the principal thing that the U.S. Army worries about in this regard, is the Mexican border. You mentioned briefly. The consequences of global warming are unevenly distributed, certainly in the early stages. So countries at a reasonably long distance from the equator, or parts of countries like Wisconsin, for example, suffer mild warming, but, you know, certainly can still feed themselves and so on, up to 2 or 3 degrees hotter. Whereas countries in the tropics and subtropics can't. They get hit early and very hard by climate change. In the subtropics, it essentially stops raining. Or rainfall drops by 75%, 50%, something. You know, the subtropics is pretty dry anyway. Most places you can only get one harvest a year.
Mm-hmm.
If you have half the rainfall, you get no harvest year. All of Mexico and Central America are in the subtropics. So is bits of the southern United States, actually. But, you know, it's a big country, and most of it's not in the subtropics. But Mexico is. You got 100 million people in Mexico now, another 70 or 80 million in the country south of there, down, say, to Panama. What happens when their farms dry up and blow away? When there isn't enough food to go around, and in those countries, and it's almost impossible to buy food to make up the difference from the global market, because this is going to be happening right across the subtropics. So, you know, the Mediterranean harvests are failing, the North Indian harvests are failing, the Australian harvest is failing. Well, actually, the Australian harvest is already failing. They're the canary in the coal mine of climate change. Southern Africa is failing. So, you know, what you're having is the same time as you're having a local disaster, you're unable to turn to the usual sources to bring in enough food to keep people going. What's the consequence of that? And the likely consequence, the consequence that people in the Quentagon foresee, is that poor Mexicans in particular, will do what they always do when they're in trouble financially or otherwise, they head north. It's a deeply embedded tradition by now in Mexico. And that will be the end of the relatively porous border that the United States still maintains with Mexico. I mean, it is partly a fictional border. It looks quite impressive in the cities along the Mexican border. I mean, you go to El Paso or you go to Tijuana or San Diego, and it looks pretty impressive, you know, barbed wire, mesh and searchlights and all the rest of it. But go 5 or 10 miles east or west from any border town into the country, mostly desert, and you're down to 3 strands of barbed wire and a dirt patrol track. And people are coming across that border in hundreds of thousands, and the U.S. catches some and it lets some go, and the ones it catches it sends back, and they come across again next week. And the reason this is tolerated is the numbers are actually reasonably bearable in terms of disruption of social services and things like that. And, of course, American farmers want cheap stoop labor, right, which is only cheap if it's illegal, because then they can't complain. So, I mean, there's a deal. It's a corrupt deal, but there's a deal. And it provides a safety valve for the Mexican state as well. And the United States wants a stable Mexico. So this has gone on for a long time, but if Mexico dries out and millions are heading north, this is not going to fly anymore. The Army is pretty well convinced. And we're talking senior levels here. This isn't the chatter in the officers' mess sort of thing, but the senior planning level. The Army is pretty well convinced that within 10 or 15 years it will be ordered by Congress to close the Mexican border.
To create a wall?
To create a wall, to make it a defended border, a border that, you know, when you cross, you have electrified wire to get through, you have landmines, you have motion detectors, you may have, you certainly have razor wire 9 feet high, and you may have actual live weapons as well as the surveillance cameras and so on, remotely controlled weapons. It's how they do things. I mean, they're building a border exactly like that right now between Saudi Arabia and Iraq. The company formerly known as Blackwater actually is doing it. It's a 10-foot deep ditch about 30 feet wide. That's where you put the motion detectors, razor wire fences in front and behind it with, you know, conventional video, infrared, ultraviolet. And you can put your remotely controlled machine guns on the rear fence, and you can put landmines down in the ditch. Nobody said they're doing that, but that's what would normally be done. You can close frontiers. Hey, we had the Iron Curtain across Europe for 40 years. But nobody came through, but you have to be willing to kill people.
And you're saying that the climate change would be the trigger that would make more and more people coming across. Before we go further into some of the sort of nightmare scenarios, the looking at what could happen in the year 2045, for example, let's take it back to right now.
Yeah.
Tell me what you would say to someone, and there are still plenty of people out there who say there is no problem with global warming. That's just a scare tactic. That's a myth. You know, how would you sort of definitively state the problem that exists right at this moment in terms of the Earth?
First of all, this is rarely said, I think, in the United States. This is about the only place where there is a large problem with disbelief, and that is, I think, the consequence of 15 years of propaganda designed to spread doubt about the science.
Why would that be? Why? What was the purpose behind that propaganda?
Well, because it was funded by the interests that thought they would be hurt if we responded to climate change by getting out of burning fossil mm-hmm. fuels and not driving cars anymore. So, mm-hmm. Coal, right. Oil, gas, and the automobile industry were... Now, the automobile industry, interestingly, doesn't fund this propaganda anymore because they've figured out they can still sell cars. They just have to use different fuel.
Right.
And, you know, ExxonMobil, previously the leader of the disbelief campaign, is now investing huge amounts of money in, you know, getting the right kind of algae to grow in vats so that you can squeeze the oil out and use that as a biofuel that will drive cars. But the consequence of that in the United States is very significant levels of disbelief, between 30% and 50%, depending on, you know, which way the wind is blowing and what the weather is today. And it's kind of right-left. I mean, you know, it tends to be people on the right who don't believe. This, again, is purely American. I mean, you know, Margaret Thatcher, who was a bit to the right of Attila the Hun, founded the British Climate Change Research Center at the Hadley Center. The current leader is in the European Union. The German Chancellor, who is right-wing again, is currently taking point on the European Union's climate change policy. So it's only here. But what would you say to people here? You'd say that there's not a division, remotely equal division, among scientists about this. You can find an occasional scientist hungry for publicity or research money or something like that to follow his particular bent who will be willing to cast doubt on the science, and there are no doubt a few people who are genuine in casting doubt on the science, but 99 out of 100 people who are in domains that are relevant to this, you know, oceanography, atmospheric physics, atmospheric chemistry, meteorology, those disciplines, 99 out of 100 are convinced that this is real.
And they can point to some actual physical things like the glaciers melting.
The
right?
glaciers are melting. The oceans are warming. They are therefore absorbing less carbon dioxide than they used to. So what we put in the air tends to stay there more. The permafrost is starting to melt at the edges and release more carbon dioxide and methane. We have fairly clear evidence of a long-term trend, though it will sometimes deviate from track for as much as 5 or 6 years, and you get a cool period. Of course you do. These are averages, but the trouble is that the average is trending up, and it's been trending up very significantly since we really got into the emissions business with the spread of mass car ownership and suburbs and all that in the 1960s. I mean, The actual hard numbers, and we have the science on this, are that we were at about 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide 200 years ago when the Industrial Revolution was getting underway. We only added about 40 parts per million in the next 150 years because, you know, no, there was we were burning coal all over the place, ran ships, ran trains, but, you know, it wasn't all that much. So we were still at only about 320 in 1950, 1960, and now we're at 395 because we've industrialized the whole planet and we're all driving around in cars and that burn fossil fuels. And the point of no return is not too far ahead. It's actually at 450 parts per million, which equates to an average warming globally of 2 degrees Celsius, so 3.5 Fahrenheit.
And when you say point of no return, you mean at that point you cannot repair the damage? You cannot
get it to go back down? People fear, because at that point the actual warming triggers natural events that add to the emissions. It's not just our tailpipes and our smokestacks anymore. It's also the peat bogs of Russia and the surface layer of water on the ocean. You know, that so that around 2 degrees, these numbers are fuzzy because obviously it doesn't start like that one day. It gradually ramps up. But the 2 degree, 450 parts per million deadline is real. It scares people. When you interview scientists about this, there's not a current of panic in a lot of the conversations because they can't see any way we can stop short of that given the way we're behaving. And given the way humans normally behave, we shouldn't even be surprised by this sort of stuff. You know, always a day late and a dollar short.
You mentioned in your book that some of the things we like to pride ourselves in, such as changing to a different kind of light bulb or recycling, that those are rather irrelevant when we look at the big picture.
Not irrelevant, but marginal. I mean, I wouldn't say irrelevant because I do it myself. And one of the reasons you do it is because every bit of power you don't use right now and every bit of, you know, biodegradable stuff that you don't put into a landfill means that we have less carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere this year and less methane and so on. Now, the carbon dioxide has the unfortunate habit of hanging around in the atmosphere once you put it there for about 200 years on average. So it's cumulative. Everything you put in stays there and will still be there in your grandchildren's time, and therefore the numbers keep going up.
And what are the big offenders? In other words, if you're trying to look at right now, if you could shut off the key sources of that carbon dioxide, the key causes of the global warming, what would the big offenders be?
The easiest ones to get at would be stop running coal-fired power plants. The United States gets 60% of its primary energy from burning coal. It's the highest in the industrialized world by far, except for China. I mean, most countries are around 30% from coal. Coal's the most polluting, most carbon dioxide producing of the fossil fuels. So stop doing that. You've got lots of alternatives. I mean, you know, do solar, do wind, do nuclear. I don't care. Just something that doesn't produce carbon dioxide because we're running out of space here. The American vehicle fleet produces a huge amount of carbon dioxide, but you're not going to get rid of your cars. What you got to do is change the fuel. That's, you know, I mean, whether you, you know, do it with electric, I rather doubt you will, or whether you do it with some kind of manufactured fuel that doesn't involve fossil carbon dioxide. If you can take carbon out of the air, carbon dioxide out of the air, and mix that with, say, hydrogen and come up with an equivalent to an octane fuel, well, you're carbon neutral. You know, that you take the carbon dioxide out of the air, you make the fuel, you burn the fuel, carbon dioxide goes back in the air. It's when you dig it out of the ground and you're putting carbon dioxide that was buried 100 million years ago back into the air that you are actually raising the total concentration. So change the fuel for your cars. Stop burning coal and stop cutting down the forests, the tropical forests in particular. We've taken down about half the tropical forest in the last 150 years. If you just let that grow back, you take 50 parts per million of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So those are quick and dirty, You haven't solved all of your problems.
Quick and clean.
Quick and clean. Yeah. You haven't solved all of your problems, but you've given yourself another 20 or 25 years before you hit the point of no return to work on the rest of the problem. And that's really the way you got to think about this, is sort of pie-shaped slices that you can take out, which will give you early big returns on cutting your carbon dioxide output and other greenhouse gases like methane. Methane is actually a worse greenhouse gas in terms of warming than carbon dioxide, but it at least doesn't last as long. 10 years and most of it's gone, any given molecule. There you go after actually your agriculture principally. The cows and the sheep of the world produce an amazing amount of methane, both ends.
We're going to look at what would happen if we don't do anything to improve the situation. In other words, we're going to explore a nightmare scenario when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air. My guest is Gwynne Dyer, and we are talking about his book, Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats. I have to say, your book is fairly scary, because what it does is not just say we have a problem with global warming, but it actually projects what would happen on a world stage if we do nothing. In other words, if we continue as we're going, what might happen in terms of wars between countries, mass starvation, mass migrations, huge changes. One of the things you include right at the beginning of your book, Gwynne, is a nightmare scenario from the year 2045. Can you say why you picked that year and then maybe go through and give us that scenario?
Well, I think really because I picked that year because it is about the maximum time horizon people can actually grasp. You know, my children will still be alive, or at least my grandchildren will be. And that is about as far as we can stretch our imaginations. If it gets a lot worse, because it will if we don't get on top of this problem by 2075 or 2080, billions are dying. Okay, I cannot actually give you a plausible scenario for that. I mean, I think it would happen if we don't get on top of this situation. But I don't even feel comfortable in dealing with things that, the mass death. If we go the full distance, and the full distance is probably about a 6 degrees higher average global temperature. The world's been there before. There are two or three stable states in the global atmosphere. One of them is about 5 or 6 degrees cooler than the present. You get ice ages and things with that. And one of them is about 5 or 6 degrees hotter. And the last time we were there, which was about 35 million years ago, there was crocodiles at the North Pole and virtually nothing living south of about where the current Canadian border is, because the lower latitudes were all howling deserts. There was, no rain. What kind of population could a world like that support? And the answer is maybe 500 million people clustered around the Arctic Ocean, which, of course, won't have the same shoreline as now because you'll have 70 meters extra of sea level rise, 200 feet. Well, getting from the current world of 7 billion to a world of 500 million is not going to be a pleasant process if that's what happens. So I never did a scenario about that. I quite deliberately decided not to. I'll stay with what I can talk about in terms of the politics that will mutate but still be recognizable, the countries and borders that I know, because otherwise you just turn into a scaremonger and you can't plausibly give details. So 2045, I think I go up to 2055 with one of them. But that's as far as I'm willing to take it. It's not that it stops getting worse. It's just that I...
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's hear your scenario for 2045. And I have to say, this almost sounds like science fiction or a dystopian novel or something, but you're projecting it in terms of if everything stays the same with population, with pollution, this is what we could be seeing on a global scale in terms of political confrontation.
Yeah. Assuming that, population will actually be a bit higher, we're probably heading for 8.5 billion, not the 7 billion we are at now, and we'll be most of the way there in 2045. That's not in here. But that is my assumption. And the assumption is not that we do nothing in terms of cutting our emissions, but that we do the sort of dabbling in the cutting of emissions that we're doing at the moment. Nothing serious. Since the final collapse of the European Union in 2036, under the stress of mass migration from the southern to the northern members, the reconfigured Northern Union, France, Benelux, Germany, Scandinavia, Poland, has succeeded in closing its borders to any further refugees from the famine-stricken Mediterranean countries. Italy, south of Rome, has been largely overrun by refugees from even harder-hit North African countries and is no longer part of an organized state. But Spain, northern Italy, calling itself Padania, and Turkey have all acquired nuclear weapons and are seeking, with little success, to enforce food sharing on the better-fed countries of northern Europe. Britain, which has managed to make itself just about self-sufficient in food by dint of a great national effort, has withdrawn from the continent and shelters behind its enhanced nuclear deterrent. Russia, the greatest beneficiary of climate change in terms of food production, is the undisputed great power of Asia. However, the reunification of China after the chaos of the 2020s and 2030s poses a renewed threat to its Siberian borders, for even the much-reduced Chinese population of 800 million is unable to feed itself from the country's increasingly arid farmland, which was devastated by the decline in rainfall over the North Chinese plain and the collapse of the major river systems. Southern India is re-emerging as a major regional power, but what used to be northern India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh remain swept by famine and anarchy due to the collapse of the flow in the glacier-fed Indus, Ganges, and Brahmaputra rivers and the increasingly frequent failure of the monsoon. Japan, like Britain, has withdrawn from its continent and is an island of relative prosperity bristling with nuclear weapons. The population of the Islamic Republic of Arabia, which had risen to 40 million, fell by half in 5 years after the exhaustion of the giant Ghawar oil field in 2020, and has since halved again due to the exorbitant price of what little food remains available for import from any source. Uganda's population, 5 million at independence in 1962, reached 110 million in 2030 before falling back to 30 million, and the majority of the survivors are severely malnourished. Brazil and Argentina still manage to feed themselves, but Mexico has been expelled from the North American Free Trade Area, leaving the United States and Canada with just enough food and water to maintain at least a shadow of their former lifestyles. The wall along the U.S.-Mexican border is still holding. Human greenhouse gas emissions temporarily peaked in 2032 at 47% higher than 1990, due largely to the dwindling oil supply and the Chinese Civil War. However, the release of thousands of megatons of methane and carbon dioxide from the melting permafrost in Arctic Canada, Alaska, and Siberia has totally overwhelmed human emissions cuts, and the process has slid beyond human ability to control. The combined total of human and what you might call neo-natural greenhouse gas emissions continues to rise rapidly, and the average global temperature at the end of the century is predicted to be 8 or 9 degrees Celsius, higher than 1990. I wrote this before the Hadley Center for Climate Research, which is probably the premier center in the world. It's in the west of England. Published a prediction late last year, just before the shambles in Copenhagen in December when they tried to get a treaty and didn't. Mm-hmm. And what it did was predict what you will actually have in 2060 on a business-as-usual basis. British government was behind this. British Foreign Secretary actually helped to present this announcement. They did assume that by then the warming will have triggered some of these natural emissions, permafrost in the oceans and so on, and fed those numbers in, which is not what you get with the figures out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We use their figures, the IPCC figures, which don't count all this stuff in because they don't feel confident about, you know, just how much damage all that will do. But, you know, come on, it's going to have some impact. So they said basically at 50 years from now, we will already be at 4 degrees higher average global temperature. That's 7 degrees Fahrenheit higher average global temperature. And they also published a map which showed you what the impact of that will be in various land areas of the planet, because an average global temperature is a temperature on a planet that's two-thirds ocean and one-third land, and oceans are cooler.
Mm-hmm.
So that average incorporates an awful lot of cool ocean and a smaller amount of warm land. How hot is that land, really? And that's the map that they published. And where we're sitting right now in the center of North America, at least 1,000 miles from any ocean, it's 7 degrees higher Celsius, which is 12 degrees higher Fahrenheit. You're not growing anything here at that rate. You know, yeah. The crops, you can't grow corn in a climate like that. A lot of areas would be desert. The deserts would be coming back west of here. There was areas west of here that were desert in sort of Montana and Wyoming.
One of the themes running through your scenario is the effect on food. Can you say something in general about what climate change would mean to the availability of food, who's going to get it, and what the demand for food would lead to on a sort of political level?
Well, this is actually where the military concentrate their attention. Almost all of their scenarios, which involve jobs for them, start with food shortages, because that's the principal impact of warming on human beings in the early stages of the process. Later on, you get all sorts of things. But the first thing that gets hit is the food supply. I mean, we saw this summer. It passed in Russia when they had, you know, extraordinary temperatures compared to what they normally have, though the average is not even 3 degrees higher. They lost half the crop. They banned exports. That'll happen in a lot of places as it gets hotter. So the food supply gets hit in the tropics and the subtropics in particular. Those countries become unable to feed themselves and collectively are unable to buy enough from the global market because there's not enough surplus to go around and meet the growing need to replace what they can't grow. Maybe even some of the temperate zone countries like Russia last summer are losing a lot of their crop production. At 5 or 6 or 7 degrees, forget it. But, you know, even at 4, you're in deep trouble. And so what do you get? You get the waves of refugees. We talked about that. You also get failed states, a proliferation of failed states, because a government that cannot feed its population has failed in its most basic responsibility, and it is unlikely to survive. And so where we now have basically one failed state, Somalia, well, maybe a couple of other halfway there, you're probably looking at dozens.
And anarchy as a result?
Anarchy, piracy, terrorism, the whole package. Particularly in Africa and the Middle East, because those areas are very hard hit by climate change early on and are politically unstable and they've got high population growth rates. All the components of a disaster are there. The refugee problem is not confined to the U.S. border with Mexico. The European Union faces refugees coming north out of Africa, west out of the Middle East, and eventually even coming out of its own southern members and the northern side of the Mediterranean, Italy, Spain, Greece, and so on. The Russians worry about China and Persia and Iran producing huge numbers of refugees heading north.
And what about the argument of, oh, back in the 19th century, very cynical kind of population theorist Thomas Malthus, who talked about the fact that it would all sort of even out because if you ran out of food, people would starve. The starvation would lead to a decline in the population, and then you wouldn't need as much food.
Yeah. I mean, it works. That's you know, if we go the full distance on this, there'll be a half a billion of us left in 150 years' time, and we'll all be living up around the Arctic Ocean, and there'll only be two world languages, Russian and English. And that's what Malthus would predict. You cut the food supply, the population will adjust downwards. Lots of wild populations go through this kind of boom and bust on a, you know, 5-year, 3-year, 7-year cycle. Deer populations, hamster populations, whatever. We are, in a sense, a wild population. Nobody's looking after us except ourselves.
And your subtitle implies that where you have the fight for survival as the world overheats, it implies we're going to have a sort of social Darwinism, that we will be struggling as to the survival of the fittest, and the fittest perhaps are the ones with the nuclear weapons?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, when you get down to a certain point, Well, there's a friend of mine. He runs the Peabody Museum in Harvard, and he's written a lot on anthropology, on hunter-gatherers and so on. And his sort of dictum is that people always raid before they starve. Now, he's talking about, you know, small-scale societies, but I think it probably applies to big-scale societies as well, and those who raid successfully are those with the better weapons, or those who repel the others who are trying to share what's left, the ones with the better weapons. I don't want to go down that road, and I don't think we are yet doomed fully to go down that road, but it's the road we're on, you know, and it behooves us to be aware of what lies around the bend.
You imagined Great Britain and Japan as sort of becoming quite insular and defending their food supplies, their prosperity with weapons and so on, and the United States defending itself with a tighter border. You mentioned earlier that Australia was a sort of canary here in the coal mine. How so?
Well, first of all, it's the driest continent. Three-quarters of it is desert now, frankly. But the other quarter grows a huge amount of wheat, or did do, as well as feeding the Australians enough for them to have a huge wheat export business. I mean, they were, even 10 years ago, they were, you know, third largest exporter of wheat in the world, you know, from year to year to fluctuate, but that was their position. Over the last couple of years, their wheat exports have dropped practically to zero because they've been going through what they thought was a drought. Now, droughts end. You know, eventually, if you just hang in there, it'll rain again. But 7 or 8 years. And the worst since there are records, since European settlement began about 250 years ago. And gradually, Australians began to realize that this probably isn't a drought. It's climate change, in which case, this is the new normal. This is what you can expect year upon year. So farm families start giving up in large numbers. And farm families in Australia have been giving up in large numbers. In the inland areas where you grow wheat, both in the east and the west of the country, huge areas. I mean, it's as much as Canada, you know, in wheat. Mm-hmm. They're just giving up. I mean, it's not just this year's and last year's wheat crop that have died. It's the prospect that they will all die from now on. So in that sense, what happens to Australia is what was likely to happen elsewhere, but it'll happen first in Australia. And I guess we're next, probably Southern Africa. But it will get home to everybody eventually. I mean, in the higher latitudes, like most of the United States, like Europe, north of the mountains, north of the Alps, like, you know, Russia, most of Russia, we have a few more years of grace before when we can still feed ourselves without titanic efforts and rationing and no more meat and all that. But, you know, you're still probably on a shorter leash than most people imagine. I mean, just think about it for a minute. The Russians have been congratulating themselves for years now, rather like the Canadians do, that in a world where everybody else takes a beating, they will be sitting pretty. They'll even have food to export, and that will be the most impressive sort of diplomatic weapon you could have because there's global shortages, and they'll say, you know, they won't actually suffer from the climate change themselves for a good long time. Well, it probably isn't true. The truth is probably that if you're in the higher latitudes and you're near the sea, then the warming will be tolerable and it will continue to rain. But if you're in the center of the continent, whether it's Russia in Europe or the Midwest in the United States, you're not doing so well because the rain probably doesn't get here much anymore. And the heat's a great deal more. I mean, down on the coast, the East Coast, or for that matter, the California coast, 4 degrees higher average global temperature, according to that map I was talking about earlier, equates to about 4.5 degrees hotter. Here it's 7 degrees hotter, all in Celsius, so almost double them if you want Fahrenheit. That does mean that a lot of the big grain-growing areas in the world, which are in the interior of continents, I mean, that's true of Australia, it's true of Argentina and Brazil, they don't grow them on the coast, they grow them, you know, up in the plateau in the interior. United States, France, they go first. So there may not be enough to go around quicker than we imagine. It is a disgrace that there is not more of a reserve. The grain reserve in the world was about 150 days eating for everybody on the planet only 10 years ago. Yeah, it's not a great heap of grain somewhere, but what's in the bins and what's in the ships sailing around the planet and so on. What, you know, measured it just before next year's northern harvest comes in. What's the minimum it's going to get to? That's the grain reserve. Well, we're down to 57 days this year from 150 10 years ago. That's not enough. No early society, the pharaonic Egypt, would have dreamt of going out, you know, going into the summer before the next harvest with only 57 days reserve. They knew better. Harvests fail.
So we're not equipped for emergencies.
We're not equipped for emergencies.
Some final thoughts on climate wars when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with University of the Air. My guest is Gwynne Dyer, and his book is entitled Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats. Toward the end of your book, when you quote from another book called Under a Green Sky by Peter Ward, I'm going to read a passage from that and ask you to comment about it because it has to do both with the change to the land, the increase in deserts, but then also the effect on the oceans. Peter Ward writes, "No wind in the 120 degree Fahrenheit morning heat and no trees for shade. There is some vegetation, but it is low, parched, stunted. Of other life, there seems little. A scorpion, a spider, winged flies, and among the roots of the desert vegetation, we see the burrows of some sort of small animals, the first mammals, perhaps. The land is a desert in its heat and aridity, but a duneless desert, for there is no wind to build the iconic structures of our Saharas and Kalaharis. The land is hot barrenness. Yet as sepulchral as the land is, it is the sea itself that is most frightening. Waves lap slowly on the quiet shore, slow motion waves with the consistency of gelatin. Most of the shoreline is encrusted with rotting organic matter, silk-like swaths of bacterial slick now putrefying under the blazing sun. We look out on the surface of the great sea itself, and as far as the eye can see, there is a mirrored flatness, an ocean without whitecaps. Yet that is not the biggest surprise. From shore to the horizon, there is but an unending purple color, a vast, flat, oily purple, not looking at all like water, not looking like anything of our world. No fish break its surface, no birds dip down looking for food. The purple color comes from vast concentrations of floating bacteria, for the oceans of Earth have all become covered with a 100-foot-thick veneer of purple and green bacterial soup."
Yeah, not a place you'd want to take a holiday, is it?
No.
He's not talking about the future, he's talking about the past. He thinks that happened and could happen again. One of the consequences of concern about climate is that we have finally, over the last 15 or 20 years, got serious about studying the history of climate. 20 years ago, people didn't realize how much fluctuation there has been in historically, prehistorically, in climates. I mean, earlier in the show I said, you know, there's three stable climate states. There's this one 5 degrees hotter and 5 degrees lower. Einstein didn't know that. You know, that's the result of relatively recent research. And one of the things that has come about, it's a hypothesis but heading towards very broad acceptance in the geological and biological communities, is that the mass extinctions of the past, and you probably heard about the big five mass extinctions when we lost like 70%, 90% of all the species in the oceans and on the land, or perhaps not so much on land. There's been five big ones. We know that one was caused by an asteroid strike, the one that got the dinosaurs 62 million years ago. For quite a while after that became clear, everybody assumed that it was asteroid strikes that did the other four too. But they couldn't find any evidence of the strike, and it didn't happen suddenly. The mass extinction 62 million years ago happened overnight, practically, which is what you'd expect with a worldwide firestorm after an asteroid hits. The others took millions of years, so it can't be asteroids. And they began working on this, and came up with a fact that gave them a clue. For significant periods in the Earth's history, when it has been very warm, mainly in the past because of 10,000-year-long eruptions of huge volcanoes, and, you know, sort of it doesn't go up as fast as our numbers are going up, but it lasts a long time, and you get that 5-degree hotter world, what happens in the oceans is very interesting, because at the moment they mix all the way to the bottom. They, you know, the top layer goes down, the bottom layer comes up, and it's, so it's nicely mixed, and there's oxygen all the way down to the bottom. There's life like ours all the way down to the bottom. But at 5 degrees hotter, they stratify. And so you got a layer that's still got oxygen at the top and a much deeper layer that has no oxygen below. I mean, whatever, you know, living things were down there have died, and no new living things can colonize this area because all that dead matter falling down through this zone eats up as it rots all the oxygen that might be available. There is one ocean like this in the world today. The Black Sea is like this. But what the scientist in question, a guy called Canfield, said was the open oceans were like this for long periods of time when it was very hot. They stratified. The hot top layer still has some oxygen in it, lots of oxygen in it perhaps, and all the sea life that we find in the fossil record is there still. But the anoxic, the layer without oxygen below that, allows the sulfur bacteria, which cannot stand oxygen, to reemerge from the mud, which is where they took refuge when this planet got an oxygen atmosphere about 3 billion years ago. And they don't allow themselves to be exposed to oxygen because it kills them. But now they can emerge and they can spread through this whole anoxic layer, which actually is gradually rising with the loss of oxygen, and that at some point, probably when the line between the top oxygenated layer and the lower anoxic layer reaches the point where light penetrates, suddenly there's an explosion in the population of these bacteria, and they rise right up to the surface and they take everything out. It's called, for the benefit of those who like scientific phrases, a chemocline upward excursion. But what happens is, so they say, that the bacteria take over the ocean right up to the surface. And so the ocean becomes completely anoxic. And, of course, there's at 5 degrees higher, there isn't much wind. The temperature of the poles and the equator is about the same, so there's not much.
So it changes the whole pattern of currents.
It changes the whole pattern of currents and winds, which are driven by temperature differences. And so the anoxic oceans then, first of all, as the bacteria rise to the surface, all the maritime life is taken out. And it's interesting that in all the mass extinctions, the loss of species in the oceans is even higher than it is on land. And then the oceans begin to emit hydrogen sulfide gas in enormous amounts, which drifts over the land. It takes out the ozone layer, so you've got hard sunlight coming in and causing mutations and killing people, or killing things. There's no people at this point. And actual poisonous hydrogen sulfide gas taking out huge numbers of animals as well. So you get a mass extinction on land, always trailing a bit behind the scale of the one in the oceans when this happens. Now, what Canfield and Peter Ward are saying, and now it's pretty widely accepted, 4 of the 5 mass extinctions happened that way. They were driven by global warming, and global warming of a natural source. And the consequences of going above 5 degrees for any length of time, probably centuries, but don't think millennia, could be to trigger the same event again.
If we're going to, in our final few minutes, try to move away from some of the scary predictions, which we've certainly established, that if things do not change, we're looking at an Earth that's in definite peril. Mm-hmm. What would you like to see happen besides the things you've mentioned with the reduction of the use of coal, reduction of the use of fossil fuels for automobiles, stopping the cutting of forests, especially tropical forests? What else do you think could be done on a sort of large scale if countries saw this as a global problem and worked on it aggressively?
It's an easy problem to solve. The difficulties are all in the politics, not in the technologies, not in what you have to do. And frankly, you don't have to abandon the comfortable lifestyle you've got. You just have to power it differently. I don't for a moment imagine that, you know, we're going to solve this by putting on hair shirts. In fact, putting on hair shirts won't help. Just make people cross. The way we solve it is by moving our industrial society off the current fossil fuel base which it evolved in onto the alternative technologies that are now available in abundance. And, you know, rather like the buggy whip industry in the beginning of the 20th century, some of the sunset industries of the fossil fuel area won't accompany us into the promised land. But we can get there because this is not that difficult a task to solve. I don't want to downplay how tricky it is, but we do actually have the alternative technologies to generate power. The ones to provide liquid fuel, which is trickier, are, well, I don't have time to go into them, but I know at least three promising routes that are getting real money put into them. And I'm pretty sure one of those horses is going to cross the finish line. Which means that you don't have to have a completely different fuel distribution system. You don't have to have, you can stick with your internal combustion engines, but the fuel comes from other sources. And that applies to a very large number of things. I mean, we are going to be a high energy society. There's only one way that 7 or 8 billion people can live on this planet, and that is as a high energy society. Our agriculture is industrialized and mechanized. So what you do is you change those things. You change the way you do your farming because there are ways to farm that produce far fewer emissions. Farming produces about 15% of global emissions. We need to get that way down because, like I said, it all accumulates. Sooner or later, you got to go to zero emissions, and sooner is better. But this is doable technically, it's doable industrially, it's doable financially, it's just very hard to do politically. And the hardest bit of it is this. Nobody's willing to do really radical cuts unless everybody else does them too, because you put yourself at a commercial and industrial trading disadvantage. So we've all got to agree on how we go about this internationally. That's what that meeting in Copenhagen was about. And the tricky bit is this. Because of the history, which is that the old rich countries have been dumping this stuff in the air for 200 years, and we are responsible for 80% of what's up there, though we're only, 1/7 of the world's population in the rich countries. We're 80% of the problem is us. We didn't mean any harm by it, but we did it. And everybody in the poor world, the developing world, maybe the rapidly industrializing world too, knows that. So you can't go out and tell them we've all got to take even cuts, guys.
Because we've been causing more than our share of the problem.
We got rich by that, so we have to take the deeper cuts. And that's politically a really difficult deal to make.
Well, Gwen Dyer, thank you for sharing your interesting observations with us.
You're welcome, Emily.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you join Norman Gilliland and me for the next University of the Year.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4, during University of the Air, Emily's guest will be author Anne-Marie Cusack, who has written a book called Cruel and Unusual, a look back at the history of punishment in this country and some speculations about the future, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.